know all about you, your childhood days, your mom and dad, your pretty face. Needing you to set me free.
Mean Mistreater by Grand Funk. You're tuned in to 101.1 FM Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is From the Cream to the Dregs, and here is a little Dixie Dregs.
Yeah.
You're tuned to 101.FM Free Radio Santa Cruz, the cream to the dregs. Here's a little Yes, Astro Traveler from the BBS recordings of 1969, BBC recordings. Again, this is Free Radio Astro Traveler.
Ladies and gentlemen, Yes.
Thank you.
You're tuned to 101.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're going to continue on with some more of these very rare live recordings of Yes, so I hope you enjoy them.
I want to let you know about something that needs to happen real soon. You got to save Free Radio. Yes, we need a new studio. We need it to be economical. It doesn't have to be a big place. It could be a small room. We'd like to have access to a bathroom. If the whole thing is clean and dry and has electricity, that's a real plus for us. Somewhere between the West Side and 41st Avenue, maybe part of your garage, or we could put a shack in your backyard. We'll consider pretty much any solution you can come up with. We're 20 years old. We're a community-supported pirate radio station. We've received official recognition 3 different times for our public service over the last 20 years, and we're offering a $300 reward to anyone who will get us a studio that we can use for at least a year. So send that email to frsc@freakradio.org. That's frsc@freakradio.org. Or you could send mail to FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, 95061.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I just signed, prior to walking in, an order directing Secretary Mattis to re-examine our military detention policy and to keep open the detention facilities in Guantanamo Bay.
In his first State of the Union address, President Trump threatens to start sending more prisoners to Guantanamo and to keep the military prison open indefinitely. This comes as Trump repeatedly links immigration with terrorism.
In recent weeks, 2 terrorist attacks in New York were made possible by the visa lottery and chain migration. In the age of terrorism, these programs present risks we can just no longer afford.
And while 2017 was the second warmest year on record, Trump never mentioned climate change or global warming.
We have ended the war on American energy, and we have ended the war on beautiful, clean coal.
Today, we'll hear excerpts from the State of the Union and get response from Marumora Villalpando, a leading undocumented immigrant rights activist who attended the State of the Union, as she fears she faces deportation. We'll also hear from Ilhan Omar, our former refugee, who has become the first Somali-American Muslim legislator in the United States, plus Bill McKibben of 350.org, and Katrina Vandenhoevel, publisher of The Nation. We'll also speak to Daniel Denver on how deporting people made Central America's gangs like MS-13 and how more deportations won't help. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump read his first State of the Union address on Tuesday night, in which he called on Congress to pass an immigration overhaul and repeatedly tried to conflate immigrants, including Dreamers, with terrorists and gang members. Among Trump's guests to the State of the Union were the parents of a young girl who was killed by members of the MS-13 gang 2 years ago in Long Island, New York. 2 girls. MS-13 is a gang that originated in Los Angeles in the 1980s and has since spread to Central America as a result of the U.S. mass deportation policies. During the lengthy address, Trump also announced he'd signed an executive order keeping the Guantanamo Bay military prison open and escalated his warmongering rhetoric against North Korea, calling the North Korean government depraved, warning it poses a nuclear risk to the United States. Trump also celebrated his massive tax overhaul, benefiting corporations and the richest Americans, among them himself and his family. Trump entered the State of the Union with the lowest approval rating of any president in modern U.S. history, entering his second year in office. We'll have more on the State of the Union after headlines. A federal judge in New York City says he will not ignore President Trump's, quote, vicious comments about Latinos as he considers whether to halt the termination of DACA. That's the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which gives nearly 800,000 young undocumented people permission to live and work in the United States. President Trump canceled DACA last fall. But on Tuesday, Judge Nicholas Garofas slammed Trump for his vicious, recurring, redundant drumbeat of anti-Latino commentary. This is New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, one of 16 attorneys general who have sued to block the termination of DACA.
It's a massive, successful program that they're attempting to shut down. The issue of discriminatory animus came up, anti-Latino sentiment as well. It was a thorough hearing. The judge was very focused on the issues, very well informed, and we look forward to getting a decision.
This comes after a San Francisco judge also issued an injunction blocking DACA's cancellation earlier this month. In financial news, the drug giant Pfizer says it's reaping a staggering $11 billion gain as a result of President Trump's tax overhaul, which massively benefited corporations and the richest Americans. President Trump and Republicans claim the tax plan would help the middle class, but a recent Reuters poll shows only 2% of surveyed workers say they've received any benefit from Trump's tax overhaul. Democratic lawmakers expressed outrage after the Trump administration announced it would not impose new sanctions against Russia, despite the fact these sanctions were enshrined in a law passed by Congress and signed by President Trump last year amidst concerns about Russia meddling in the 2016 election. Instead, the State Department released a list of prominent Russian political leaders and oligarchs. The oligarchs list is an exact copy of Russians listed on the Forbes magazine 2017 billionaires list. This is New Hampshire Democratic Senator Jean Shaheen.
Well, the Trump administration has had 6 months to configure a sanctions regime, sanctions based on a vote, as you heard from Senator Brown, 517-5 in Congress. And what did they come up with? They gave us this list. This is the unclassified list. As Senator Cardin said, the oligarchs that are part of this list are taken from Forbes magazine.
This comes as the CIA director, Mike Pompeo, recently met with top Russian officials, including the head of Russian intelligence. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, known as FEMA, is ending shipments of food and water to Puerto Rico today, 4 months after Hurricane Maria devastated the island. About a third of Puerto Rico has still no electricity. Some rural areas still have no clean running water. San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz criticized FEMA's move while speaking at a gathering of Latino leaders in Washington, D.C., saying, quote, "While I'm standing here with you, there are children without food in Puerto Rico. We need the help, and it's not help. We have paid for it," Mayor Cruz said. She attended the State of the Union address with New York Senator Gillibrand. In Honduras, a delegation of faith leaders from the United States is denouncing the United States' support for Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who's been inaugurated for a second term despite allegations of widespread voting fraud in the November 26 election. This is Reverend Kathleen McTeague of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee speaking outside the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa Monday.
We call on our United States government to withdraw its recognition of the fraudulently elected government in Honduras. And we demand the investigation and prosecution of both those directly responsible for and those behind the killings during the protests from November 27th till today.
In Colombia, longtime land defender and community leader Temistocles Machado has been assassinated in the port city of Buenaventura. Known to the community as Temis, he helped lead the massive three-week-long civic strike in the Afro-Colombian city this past summer, which is protesting widespread violence in the region and a lack of basic services such as clean water. The Polish parliament has sparked outrage by passing a bill that would make it a crime punishable by up to 3 years in prison to suggest the Polish government was complicit in Nazi-era crimes. Opponents say the bill seeks to rewrite and erase the history of Poland's anti-Jewish pogroms leading up to World War II and the collaboration between the Polish state and Nazi Germany after the Nazis occupied Poland in 1939. in Turkey. More than 300 people have been arrested for posting messages online criticizing the Turkish military offensive against the Syrian city of Afrin, a majority Kurdish city controlled by a U.S.-backed militia. The Turkish government says those arrested include journalists, politicians, and activists. The government is accusing them of spreading terrorist propaganda by speaking out against the deadly military offensive. In Egypt, a coalition of opposition parties and pro-democracy groups are calling for a boycott of Egypt's upcoming presidential elections. The authoritarian Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, is almost certain to win the March elections after nearly all of his challengers were arrested or disqualified. In Japan, a woman has filed a landmark lawsuit suing the Japanese government for sterilizing her without her consent because of a mental disability when she was 15 years old. She's one of an estimated 16,000 people in Japan who were forcibly sterilized under Japan's eugenics law, which was enforced from 1948 to 1996. In France, Oxford professor and renowned Islamic scholar Tariq Ramadan has been detained in Paris after he was accused by two women of rape and sexual assault last year. Ramadan has denied the accusations. And Jean Sharp, a lifelong advocate of nonviolent resistance, has died at the age of 90. Jean Sharp was most famous for his extensive writings on nonviolent struggle, which include the influential book From Dictatorship to Democracy, A Conceptual Framework for Liberation. He was also the founder of the Albert Einstein Institution, which is dedicated to advancing the study of nonviolent action. This is Jean Sharp accepting the Right Livelihood Award in 2012.
Nonviolent struggle or nonviolent action includes three categories of methods, specific means of acting. One, the methods of nonviolent protest that are symbolic activities, such as marching down the street or displaying certain colors. But this technique, if it had only that, wouldn't be worth much. It also includes the much more powerful methods of non-cooperation, such as social boycotts, economic boycotts, labor strikes, political boycotts, civil disobedience, and thirdly, the methods of nonviolent intervention and disruption, such as sit-ins, fasts, and the creation of new institutions.
Jean Sharp died Sunday at the age of 90 at his home in Boston. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump delivered his first State of the Union Tuesday, claiming this is, quote, our new American moment. He focused heavily on immigration, renewing his call for a border wall while linking immigration to terrorism.
In recent weeks, two terrorist attacks in New York were made possible by the visa lottery and chain migration. In the age of terrorism, these programs present risks we can just no longer afford. It's time to reform these outdated immigration rules and finally bring our immigration system into the 21st century.
President Trump never mentioned the words climate change or global warming, but he did acknowledge the recent deadly hurricanes and wildfires that devastated parts of the country.
To everyone still recovering in Texas, Florida, Louisiana, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands, everywhere, we are with you, we love you, and we always will pull through together, always.
That was President Trump's only reference to Puerto Rico, where today FEMA's ending shipments of food and water, even though about a third of the island still has no electricity over 4 months after Hurricane Maria struck. On the foreign policy front, Trump threatened North Korea again, suggested he'll start sending more prisoners to the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo in Cuba, where no new prisoner has been sent in almost a decade.
I just signed, prior to walking in, an order directing Secretary Mattis, who is doing a great job. Thank you. To reexamine our military detention policy and to keep open the detention facilities in Guantanamo Bay. Congress to ensure that in the fight against ISIS and Al-Qaeda, we continue to have all necessary power to detain terrorists wherever we chase them down, wherever we find them. And in many cases, for them, it will now be Guantanamo Bay.
The prison population at Guantanamo is currently 41, down from a high of 684 in 2003. President Trump also used the State of the Union to issue a veiled threat to federal workers.
So tonight I call on Congress to empower every cabinet secretary with the authority to reward good workers and to remove federal employees who undermine the public trust or fail the American people.
Well, today we spend the hour looking at what President Trump said and didn't say during his State of the Union. We begin with Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation, America's oldest weekly magazine. Overall, your response to what you saw last night?
You know, last July, Amy, at a rally in Youngstown, President Trump said, one speech isn't going to make me presidential. It takes a lot more than that. We heard platitudes and promises. We heard warmongering. We heard a lot about scams, and I think, let me step back. You just were talking about Guantanamo. I think one of the ugliest moments was when the president cheered on his move to move the capital of the embassy to Jerusalem, along with reopening Gitmo for business. And you had a Republican Party. Let's not forget Trump is the head of a Republican Party, a radically extreme Republican Party, cheering on defiance of international law and human rights. And I think that was a telltale moment, because that is what this administration is about on the foreign policy front. He is a false populist. He ran as an ethno-reactionary populist, but a populist. And last night was littered with broken promises, even as he promised more. I'm not going to hold my breath for lower drug prices, which he spoke of. I'm not going to hold my breath for more treatment of an opioid crisis, which, as you probably know, in 2016, there were more opiate overdoses than combat deaths in Vietnam. And he has scammed the American people with a tax cut I know you've talked a lot about on this program, which was essentially a handout to the very rich and the big corporations and to his own family. And last night he tried to boast that this was a tax cut for the American people. It is looting our future, what this tax cut does. It fails to invest in a future, which, if the Democrats were wise, they would put out a bold, bold plan in the next few days about what they would do specifically on these issues of jobs, of infrastructure, not a privatized infrastructure plan, of real health care, Medicare for all, of tuition-free higher ed, and get real specific about what they are going to do for working people in this country. And working people, by the way, of all colors, because there's too often pitting class versus identity, when in fact the working class is brown, black, yellow, white.
When you talk about pitting, there was direct references to immigrants taking poor Americans' jobs. But I want to go to that issue in a moment. But first, to the foreign policy front, where President Trump said he would beef up the U.S. nuclear arsenal, dismissing global efforts to ban nuclear weapons.
As part of our defense, we must modernize and rebuild our nuclear arsenal, hopefully never having to use it, but making it so strong and so powerful that it will deter any acts of aggression by any other nation or anyone else. Perhaps someday in the future there will be a magical moment when the countries of the world will get together to eliminate their nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, we are not there yet, sadly.
That was President Trump in his first official State of the Union address. Katrina VandenHeuvel.
So before the nuclear issue, don't forget he also said he wanted to break the spending caps, this defense sequester, the parity between defense and non-defense spending, which is a major issue because so much already goes into defense, not making us more secure. Our Pentagon budget is at a historic high, rife with waste and abuse. We do not need more. With the modernization of nukes, I think it makes us less secure, and it is a continuation, sadly, of President Obama's plan to modernize the nuclear arsenal. He was going to throw $1 trillion, I think, over 3 decades. This is folly. What we should be doing is building down, de-escalating. What is striking, Amy, is that Trump as president has elevated the nuclear issue and the North Korea peril to a new high because people are concerned about his, quote, finger on the nuclear button. But we need to be concerned about the security architecture of a nuclear arsenal that is rife with possible accidents, false alerts, as we saw in Hawaii a few weeks ago. And I think at a minimum, we need to begin to take them off of hair trigger alert, the nuclear arsenal, and end first use. There is legislation in Congress, as you may know, from Ted Lieu and Senator Markey to ensure that there be some congressional involvement in any use. But President Trump probably doesn't know someone, I don't know how he feels about him, I know how you do, you know, Henry Kissinger, General Shalakashvili, Senator Nunn, former Senator Nunn, former Clinton Defense Secretary, William Perry, have all come out for the abolition of nuclear weapons, as have the majority of countries in the world through the General Assembly at the United Nations last year, putting through a treaty, 151 nations, I believe, to seek the build down and end of nuclear weapons. That is true security, not a president who talks and rattles his thumbs and his fingers and his Twitter feed against the leader of North Korea, nor is a president who tries to decertify the Iran agreement, which is in our security interest, and if it's broken, will lead to more nuclear proliferation and less security. This president is clueless when it comes to what real security is, and he's out of step with a majority of Americans who listened to him on the campaign trail when he spoke of the waste of $6 trillion in the Middle East, which could rebuild this country. Do you know, Amy, that counties where they've had lost so many sons and daughters to endless war voted for Trump because they believed he might end endless war. This country's not anti-war, but it is against endless war and seeks realism and restraint.
We're going to break and then come back to this discussion. Katrina VandenHeuvel, our guest editor and publisher of The Nation, America's oldest weekly magazine, will also be joined by State Representative Ilhan Omar. She is the first Somali-American Muslim legislator in the United States. She was in Washington, D.C. from Minnesota to participate in one of the alternative State of the Union events. We'll also be speaking with a woman who was inside Congress last night, who is a guest of a senator. We'll be speaking with Marumora Villalpando, who herself faces deportation, an undocumented immigrant just yards from President Trump. In addition, we'll be talking to Bill McKibben. The words global warming or climate change, climate chaos, were not mentioned by President Trump, though he talked about beautiful coal. And we'll speak with a journalist, Daniel Denver, who's written an article for the Washington Post, among others, saying that U.S. deportation policies were responsible for gangs like MS-13. Stay with us.
Strong, but you needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof. Rufus Wainwright singing Leonard Cohen's song Hallelujah to the video of protests around the country. He was singing at an alternative State of the Union, a People's State of the Union, held at Town Hall in New York on Monday night. This is Democracy Now! As we look at President Trump's first State of the Union, spending the hour on it. On Tuesday night, some Democrats in the chamber booed when President Trump used the term chain migration and tried to link terrorist attacks to policies allowing recent immigrants to sponsor relatives.
The fourth and final pillar protects the nuclear family by ending chain migration. Under the current broken system, a single immigrant can bring in virtually unlimited numbers of distant relatives. Under our plan, we focus on the immediate family by limiting sponsorships to spouses and minor children. This vital reform is necessary not just for our economy, but for our security and for the future of America. In recent weeks, two terrorist attacks in New York were made possible by the visa lottery and chain migration. In the age of terrorism, these programs present risks we can just no longer afford. It's time to reform. These outdated immigration rules, and finally bring our immigration system into the 21st century.
That was President Trump at his State of the Union. Joining us now, Minnesota State Representative Ilhan Omar, former refugee Muslim, the highest elected Somali American public official in the United States. You were in Washington, D.C. from Minnesota to attend one of the alternative State of the Unions, Ilhan Omar. Can you respond to what President Trump said last night?
Thank you, Amy, for having me. I was sort of listening to that little bizarre bit about our immigration programs being outdated, and the only thing I could think about was his fascist ideas being outdated.
Talk specifically about these linkages he made continually, this line he drew between young people coming to the United States over the border and MS-13 killing people.
And it is really disappointing, and it saddens me, but it doesn't surprise me that this person can't comprehend how dangerous it is to create a link between people who might be committing some atrocious crimes to immigrants that are coming to this country seeking a brighter future for their children, and the countless people from Central America and South America who are coming to this country for opportunities that my family came here for, and many of the immigrants before us came. It is unbecoming of a president and a leader to be able to make those kind of disturbing and disgusting links.
You're a part of a group, as a young Somali-American Muslim legislator, of America's Cabinet, a nonpartisan project launched by young elected officials. Can you talk about what this is?
Yeah, we realized that this past year we could be in the streets, we could resist some of the horrendous ideas that are coming out of Washington, or we could, and or we could get involved as young electeds who have fluency and understanding of what our constituents need. We believe we have bold ideas that are going to lead our country to be able to keep up with fulfilling its promise.
I wanted to bring Madhumora Villalpando into this conversation, an activist and undocumented immigrant with the group Northwest Detention Center Resistance and the group Mi Gente. She attended the State of the Union address last night as a guest of Washington Senator Maria Cantwell. Madhu, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about what the atmosphere was like inside Congress as President Trump spoke and the significance of your being there.
Quite awful for me to sit next to a lot of people that were cheering him up. At some point, I was able to see him clap for himself. I decided to sit down throughout the entire speech. I did not clap at all. I did get a glimpse of other couple of people also sitting down. When we saw each other, like a young man at the same row that I was, but at the end of the row, we just left, raised our left fist to each other, trying to endure the whole entire speech that it felt really, really long. People stared at me when I didn't get up. Again, I saw a couple of people here and there not standing up either. And I think the most important thing for me, it was that Trump's police, Immigration Customs Enforcement, came to my house last month via certified mail, starting a deportation process against me. And when Senator Cantwell's office called me and invited me to join, I felt that it was my opportunity to show Trump himself that we are not going to get intimidated. We are going to continue working. People in detention called me yesterday throughout the day and told me we cannot be there, but you have been the voice. We have selected you. You have a task to do, and you have to be there and endure whatever he says. We knew it was a racist, xenophobic speech. He scapegoated my community along with many other communities. But it was important to show that we're not afraid and we're going to continue in the struggle.
Now, CNN reported that Congressman Paul Gosar said he requested U.S. Capitol Police arrest undocumented immigrants attending the State of the Union. The Arizona Republican, who's known as an immigration hardliner, tweeted his request that police consider checking identification of all attending the State of the Union address and arresting any illegal aliens in attendance, he said. Madhu, talk about your own situation, not only that you, well, might have been arrested right there, but in Washington State, you're a longtime, well-known immigrants' rights activist. But talk about the letter you recently got.
Yeah, on December 20th, as my daughter and I were heading out, we heard a knock at the door, and it was the mail person handing me a letter, and I saw a logo from Immigration Customs Enforcement. I knew exactly what it was, and it's called a notice to appear, where the government, the U.S. government, via Immigration Customs Enforcement, is beginning a deportation process against me, saying that I overstayed a visa back in 96, a tourist visa, and that I need to appear before a judge. It did not include a date, but included the location, which is in downtown Seattle.
I want to go back to part of what President Trump said last night about his immigration plan.
Struggling communities, especially immigrant communities, will also be helped by immigration policies that focus on the best interests of American workers and American families. For decades, open borders have allowed drugs and gangs to pour into our most vulnerable communities. They've allowed millions of low-wage workers to compete for jobs and wages against the poorest Americans. Most tragically, they have caused the loss of many innocent lives.
Madhumora Villalpando, your response?
Well, I was trying to contain myself. It's easy to see how he was pinning people against each other, low-income workers or either brown, black communities, white communities, but also scapegoating my community, immigrant communities. It was really shocking to me to see how he utilized people's tragedies to blame my community, my immigrant community, for those tragedies. It was also even more shocking to see people of color there standing and clapping for him and really being used, as we have been used in general in politics, but using people's tragedies to scapegoat our communities without talking about the real reasons why there's violence in our communities, created precisely by the same governments that created the conditions for why people end up being violent. I think that it was just a huge racist, xenophobic, nativist rhetoric. And again, I just tried to go throughout the night thinking, I have to be here, and I know that even though the majority of people there were clapping and standing for him, I knew that people outside would not agree with him.
In his State of the Union address, President Trump mentioned the MS-13 gang four times by name and told the story of the two young teenage girls who were murdered by members of the gang in Long Island. Let's go to that part of State of the Union.
For decades, open borders have allowed drugs and gangs to pour into our most vulnerable communities. They've allowed millions of low-wage workers to compete for jobs and wages against the poorest Americans. Most tragically, they have caused the loss of many innocent lives. Here tonight are two fathers and two mothers, Evelyn Rodriguez, Freddie Cuevas, Elizabeth Alvarado, and Robert Mickens. Their two teenage daughters, Kayla Cuevas and Nisa Mickens, were close friends on Long Island. But in September 2016, on the eve of Nisa's 16th birthday, such a happy time it should have been, neither of them came home. These two precious girls were brutally murdered while walking together in their hometown. Six members of the savage MS-13 gang have been charged with Kayla and Nisa's murders. Many of these gang members took advantage of glaring loopholes in our laws to enter the country as illegal, unaccompanied, alien minors and wound up in Kayla and Nisa's high school. Tonight, I am calling on Congress to finally close the deadly loopholes that have allowed MS-13 and other criminal gangs to break into our country.
That was President Trump last night as he talked about young people coming over the border and joining MS-13. Daniel Denver is with us from Providence, Rhode Island, writer in residence at Harvard Law School's Fair Punishment Project. Last year, he wrote an article for The Washington Post headlined, "Deporting People Made Central America's Gangs. More Deportation Won't Help." Daniel, welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about his one of the central focuses last night, MS-13.
I mean, political rhetoric around immigration so often functions to obscure the reality and history of immigration, though Trump is a rather extreme case. And what his obsessive focus on MS-13 does, aside from scapegoating and facilitating the mass criminalization of Latino immigrants in this country, is obscure the origins and reality of gangs like MS-13. MS-13 was born in Los Angeles amidst the refugees fleeing President Reagan's dirty wars in El Salvador, and became a transnational gang that ultimately did so much to destabilize El Salvador precisely because of deportation policies pursued by President Trump's predecessors. This is a problem that's American-made through and through. So to treat it as though it's some external threat being foisted on Americans, it not only entirely takes out of proportion and exaggerates the criminal threat that MS-13 poses to Americans, it obscures the fact that it's our foreign policies, our military interventions, and our long history that unfortunately well precedes Donald Trump of mass deportations and criminalization of immigrants that created MS-13 in the first place.
And talk more about that as you fully develop it in your piece and your work, even why it's called MS-13, but to explain that history, Daniel.
Yeah, so Mara Salvatrucha was formed in L.A. in the 1980s. Older viewers are probably fully aware, and many younger ones as well, that in the 1980s, President Reagan was backing a right-wing government in El Salvador that was waging a brutal, dirty war against leftist revolutionaries in that country that sent huge numbers of refugees fleeing to the U.S. He also had similar dirty wars in Guatemala, as well as the Contra war against the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. But in the case of Salvadoran refugees fleeing to the U.S., Reagan made a point of denying that they were refugees, because how could his friendly government in El Salvador be sending refugees fleeing from their country if they weren't committing massive human rights abuses, which they were? And so coming into segregated neighborhoods in the U.S., where, like many poor people of color in this country, they were denied access to good jobs and good schools, young people gravitated towards gangs that were a thoroughly American phenomenon at the time, not one that they were bringing with them from El Salvador. And then in the 1990s, Bill Clinton's harsh anti-immigrant policy, which he was using as part of his general strategy of triangulation, attempting to placate rising right-wing anti-immigrant sentiment to ward off the right and consolidate white support in advance to advance his own political ambitions, launched a mass crackdown on so-called criminal aliens. And those same policies were followed by George W. Bush and also by Barack Obama. And the result was that enormous numbers of people have been deported to Central America, including El Salvador, some of them alleged gang members, many of them not. But those people being deported back into El Salvador brought Mara Salvatrucha and other gangs to that country and turned what was a homegrown L.A. phenomenon into a transnational criminal empire. Again, Trump entirely exaggerates the criminal threat that MS-13 poses to the U.S., but those gangs have played a major role in wreaking incredible violence and destabilization in Central America, in El Salvador. And that violence, that destabilization, along with U.S.-backed mano dura crackdowns in the region, have pushed a new generation of refugees to come to the U.S. And now Trump has the gall to say that it's this new generation of refugees, young unaccompanied minors, who are a threat to us as Americans. I mean, it's absurd, it's offensive, and it's an insult to history, because U.S. policy has created MS-13 through and through. I think for Trump, it's just a convenient way to scapegoat and facilitate the criminalization of ordinary immigrants, which is something that he's been doing since he announced his campaign and said that Mexican immigrants were rapists and criminals.
And Maru Mora Villalpando, your response to that trajectory he made, the thread that wove through the fabric of his speech last night, young people coming over the border, MS-13, killing young women in Long Island, New York.
Again, it's just plain racist hate rhetoric that is trying to blame us for what David just explained. There's many different reasons why there's violence in this country. He obviously left aside all the other violence that white people have generated in this country, a lot of terrorist acts, but majority of them being done by white people in this country. To me, it's really, really offensive, too, that even the way he described children. We actually are working with a young man in the detention center in Tacoma. He's been detained. He came from El Salvador precisely, escaping gang violence. He came as a minor, and as soon as he turned 18, he was sent to the detention center. He already won his case, and the government, the U.S. government, decided to appeal his winning in court, in immigration court, and they still kept him in detention. He's still detained, along with another young man that we're working with, Manuel Abrego, that won his case, also from El Salvador, under the Convention Against Torture. The U.S. government appealed his case. he won back in November, he's still detained right now in the detention center. So this is just another way of keeping us in detention, making sure that our bodies, our brown and black bodies, are being used for profiteering, for, in this case, Geo Group to make more money, and for ICE to claim that they're supposedly creating a safe environment for us when what they're doing is continuing destroying our communities.
As you talk about violence, I wanted to turn back to Ilhan Omar, Minnesota state representative, the only Somali-American Muslim legislator in the country. Back in 2016, State Representative Omar, in Washington, D.C., you were attacked by a cab driver who called you ISIS and threatened to rip off your hijab as you were leaving a policy training at the White House. Shortly after the attack, you wrote on Facebook, quote, "The most hateful, derogatory, Islamophobic, sexist taunts and threats I have ever experienced. I'm still shaken by this incident and can't wrap my head around how bold people are becoming in displaying their hate towards Muslims." If you can talk about the atmosphere in this country over the last year, I couldn't help noticing last night in the chamber as President Trump spoke, many of the African-American legislators, Congress members, were wearing African kente cloth, whether it was scarves or bow ties, whether it was ties. Ilhan Omar, your response.
I mean, the rhetoric surrounding Muslims and Islam in this country has become a very dangerous one. When you sort of dehumanize and you normalize people's ability to take a violent action against individuals because they don't agree with the God they pray to, or they don't wear a clothing that you might approve, it sort of it starts us down a path that becomes very dangerous. And for a lot of our young kids in the schools, in workplaces, and just like I was roaming around the streets in D.C. Trying to do the work I was elected to do, you are faced with not only hate that comes in the form of verbally, but it gets very physical at times, and a lot of our communities are living in fear. It's the same thing with what's happening around the conversation with immigrants. With all the lies that are being told by the president and the Republicans, we are forgetting that immigrants in a lot of our communities are contributing economically. They are making the cultures of those communities thrive, and they, you know, are not in that category of criminals solely the contributors to criminal activity in this country, as the president makes it seem. I mean, if we think about our prison system, you know, over 10% of the American population is imprisoned, and it's less than 5% of them are immigrants. We don't see a conversation, an outcry about what to do when it comes to white men who are being radicalized, who are going into our schools, in our churches, in our movie theaters, terrorizing our communities. There isn't a plan. There isn't a conversation. There isn't an outrage. I didn't hear a beep from the president last night about what he plans to do to keep Americans safe so that they are able to go see a concert, so that they are able to feel comfortable sending their 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds, and 10-year-olds to school. And so when we are thinking about what makes America great, what keeps our country safe, is about having a principled leader who is seen as someone who cares about and is going to work in collaboration with other world leaders and really talk about the values of this country. Far too long, I feel like, we're letting fear drive our foreign policy. We're letting fear drive our domestic policy. And that makes us away from the actual values and the leading of with our morality that has gotten us to be the greatest nation in the world.
State Representative Ilhan Omar, the Virginia Democratic Congressman Bobby Scott tweeted, wearing kente cloth to the SOTU with my fellow official CBC members, you know, Congressional Black Caucus members, to stand in solidarity with people from you-know-what countries. And I'm wondering if you, very quickly before we go to break, could respond to that comment as a Somali refugee when President Trump made that comment about the continent of Africa, talking about these S-hole countries. And if it, what kind of blowback did you feel?
Yeah, my home country is included in that bleep. Countries and I am proud. I've never been ashamed of where I come from, and I know that so many people have appreciated the fact that Africa and many of the countries within Africa are considered the birth of civilization, and we bring so much culture and enrichment to this world. And it is really important for people to have conversations about that, and to not only stand in solidarity, but to also speak up and speak out about those kind of vulgar words that the president might use.
Well, we're going to go to break and come back to this roundtable discussion in response to President Trump's State of the Union. Stay with us.
Presidente, pregunto por qué matan al moreno con piel de café. Si fuera presidente, honestamente, si fuera presidente,
President by Las Cafeteras performing in Democracy Now! Studios. To see our interview and their performances, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we spend the hour looking at President Trump's first State of the Union, President Trump referring to the extreme weather events that hit the U.S. last year, but never mentioning the words, oh, climate change, during his speech.
We have endured floods and fires and storms, but through it all, we have seen the beauty of America's soul and the steel in America's spine.
While President Trump never actually mentioned climate change, he had this to say about coal.
We have ended the war on American energy, and we have ended the war on beautiful, clean coal.
President Trump apparently added the word beautiful to clean coal because the transcript that was sent around did not say beautiful. Well, joining us now, Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org. Today he's taking part in an event in Washington, D.C. called Climate State of the Union with Vermont Senator, former presidential candidate. We'll see if he's a future presidential candidate, Senator Bernie Sanders. Bill McKibben, welcome to Democracy Now! Your response to the State of the Union last night.
Well, as you said, he barely mentioned and didn't mention what's probably the single biggest problem facing the planet. That's because he doesn't think it's a problem. The president is under the illusion that climate change is a hoax invented by the Chinese. The stuff about coal was, by this point, everybody knows that clean coal is an oxymoron. The beautiful clean coal part was strange. It kind of betrays an impoverished fantasy life or something. I don't know. But maybe the scariest part was lauding ExxonMobil for its plans to invest another $50 billion building yet more pipelines and yet more fossil fuel infrastructure in this country. That's clearly where President Trump wants to take us. It's clearly flying in the face not only of climate change, but of the economics of energy, which wants to send us straight in the direction of sun and wind. This was a very, very backward-looking speech, not only on immigration, which was horrible to hear, but also on these questions about the future of our economy and our energy life.
Well, talking about the future, you were just here in New York a few weeks ago with Naomi Klein, standing next to New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. Can you talk about the significance of what happened?
Yeah, and actually, this is the kind of important pivot here. I mean, when we do this big event tonight, this live stream that we're calling Fossil Free Fast, one of the things we'll be pointing out is we can't make the future we need in Washington right now. There's no hope of getting good legislation through Congress anytime soon, so we have to go elsewhere, to cities and states. New York City was a huge step along that path when earlier this month it announced that it was divesting $200 billion in pension funds from the fossil fuel industry and that it was going to sue the five biggest oil companies for the damage that they've done to that city and every place else on the planet. It was a really striking moment, and there'll be many, many more of those moments going forward because cities and states are going to have to step up and fill the vacuum that President Trump and really all of Washington is leaving at this point.
After President Trump spoke last night, Senator Bernie Sanders recorded his own response to the State of the Union.
During the campaign, Donald Trump told us, quote, the rich will not be gaining at all, end of quote, under his tax reform plan. The rich will not be gaining at all. Well, that was quite a whopper. As president, the tax reform legislation Trump signed into law a few weeks ago provides 83% of the benefits to the top 1%, drives up the deficit by $1.7 trillion, and raises taxes on 92 million middle-class families by the end of the decade.
That was Senator Sanders. The official Democratic response was Congressmember Joe Kennedy III. But what Bernie Sanders is saying and what he's doing tonight with Bill McKibben and others, the significance of his voice right now, just to explain.
So, Katrina. Of course, Bernie Sanders has a significant voice coming off the campaign of 2016. But I think what Bill said is so important. What's happening in cities and states, both elected leaders and movement activists, we are seeing the resurgence not only of citizen engagement and activism, but getting things done, whether it's California or New York City, but also Arcadia, Jackson, Mississippi. There's a lot going on in this country. And I think what Bernie Sanders is showing the way is Democrats can't simply, though they must, expose Trump's bait and switch on working people, the tax scam, but they need to lay out a bold, clear alternative agenda, a kind of social contract for the 21st century. Trump last night had the chutzpah to talk about a 21st century immigration plan. As Bill said so well, what we heard last night was retro, was ugly nostalgia for a country that isn't going to come back through coal. And tell a kid with asthma about beautiful, clean coal. What we need are new pathways forward, humane, serious, and working with citizens and working with activists. So I think there's a real possibility. The bad news is Trump is president. The good news is, as Bernie Sanders said the other day, we've seen a revitalization of democracy and citizen activism. And people running for office, Amy, for the first time in years, people who never thought of it, want to change and take control of this country.
And Bill McKibben, in 2 seconds we have left, the event that's happening tonight, if people can't go directly, you're doing it online?
It'll be live in Washington and then online. And I'll say, when Bernie gets up to speak, I'll be thinking in the back of my head, it wouldn't have taken too many twists of fate for him to have been giving the State of the Union address last night. We should keep in mind that he's the most popular politician in America. So there's a lot to build on here, on climate, on immigration, on everything else.
I want to thank you all for being with us. 350.org's Bill McKibben, The Nation Magazine's Katrina Vandenhoevel, Maru Mora Vilpando, who is in Congress last night, Minnesota State Representative Ilhan Omar, and journalist Daniel Denver. Thanks so much for joining us. We have a job opening, full-time news fellow. Submit your application. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah. Transmitting live and direct, man, from the planet Earth. It's your boy, Opio Lindsay, representing Souls of Mischief Hieroglyphics crew, man. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, online at freakradio.org. Unlicensed, commercial, free, man. Underground shit, pirate radio, the shit I fuck with, you know what I mean? All right, I take mine. I don't ask for it, you know what I mean? Let's get this shit real hip-hop, baby. One love.
This idea of arguing against incarceration for youth, just across the board, arguing against incarceration and for rehabilitation. We have, on average, about 1 million arrests per year. About 25% of those cases go through the adult court system. On any given day, there are about 50,000 kids sitting in juvenile detention, and there are another 10,000 kids sitting in an adult correctional facility, mostly a jail, right, where they're awaiting their hearings. And that's just crazy. That's a huge amount of kids.
That's Kara Drynan, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Kara Drynan on the justice system's war on kids. The juvenile justice system is off the rails. It is in urgent need of reform. The United States incarcerates roughly 2 million children every year, even though 95% of them have not been convicted of a violent crime. Too many of them are held in adult jails. The systemic problems range from racism to brutality and extreme sentencing. Thousands of kids, many of them suffering from trauma, come of age behind bars. 2/3 of them have mental health issues. They are subject to physical and sexual assault. They are up to 36 times more likely to commit suicide after being housed in an adult jail or prison than children incarcerated in juvenile facilities. The Equal Justice Initiative says confinement of children in adult facilities is indefensible, cruel, and unusual punishment and should be banned. Our guest today is Kara Drynan. She's professor of law at Catholic University and is a recognized expert on juvenile sentencing and criminal justice reform. She's the author of The War on Kids, How American Juvenile Justice Lost Its Way. She spoke at Town Hall in Seattle. And now, Kara Drynan.
I want to begin by telling you a little bit about Terrence Graham. So in 2003, when Terrence was 16, he and three teens attempted to rob a barbecue restaurant in Jacksonville, Florida. They entered through a back door at closing time. They fled when the angry manager confronted them. And one of Terrence's co-defendants had a metal bar that night, and he did strike the manager, sending him to the emergency room for stitches. And I don't mean to minimize that, but just to say that no one was seriously injured in this event. And Terrence himself did not use or even wield a weapon during any of this. And nonetheless, Terrence was sentenced to life without parole for his involvement in that attempted armed robbery. And so you hear that and you think like, oh my gosh, you know, how does that happen? And maybe one of the saddest parts of his case is not just the sentencing structure that made that possible, but the fact that the Florida judge who imposed that sentence, before he imposed it, he kind of wondered aloud why Terrence would throw his life away when he'd been given, you know, what the judge said was quite a family structure. In fact, he said, I don't understand why you'd be given such an opportunity to do something with your life and why you'd throw it away. And in fact, nothing could have been farther from the truth, right? So what I came to learn in my research and in getting to know Terrence is that he grew up in abject poverty. He had two crack-addicted parents. His mother obtained her crack by allowing others to get high in the home. It's called paying the house lady. So there were often adults in the home getting high, and they didn't want to hear the sounds of young children. So Terrence and his brothers, from the time they were very young, were often sent out into the streets of Jacksonville just to create quiet space in the home. Terrence endured physical, emotional, and verbal abuse that was documented by social services from the time he was a toddler. He was diagnosed with ADHD in his youth, but he was never medicated. His mother would not allow it. When I met Terrence in 2012, I asked him about his schooling experience because I was curious in particular about the ADHD and his time in school, and his answer was, it's really hard to be in school when you're hungry. So by the time he was in the 10th grade, he was arrested that year for that armed robbery that I mentioned. By that time, he'd attended 9 schools because his family was moving so often from one subsidized housing unit to another. And so life was violent and chaotic for Terrence his entire childhood, despite what that judge said at his sentencing in 2005. And sadly, Terrence is not alone. In my opinion, the United States has waged a war on kids. And like most wars, this particular war has had the biggest impact on poor, minority, and otherwise vulnerable youth like Terrence. So this is what the war on kids looks like. Today in the United States, prosecutors routinely transfer kids out of juvenile court into the adult court system, often without judicial oversight. Youth in adult court are subject to mandatory minimums that were drafted with adults in mind. Youth can be housed in adult correctional facilities, despite the fact that we know youth in those facilities are at the highest risk for physical and sexual assault. Youth are subject to conditions of confinement that I think most of us would think of as only appropriate for adult offenders, and really even the most violent among those adult offenders. So things like mechanical restraints, even solitary confinement. Until 2005, the United States was the only developed nation in the world that executed people for juvenile crimes. And today, we are the only developed nation in the world that sentences our children to die in prison. How did this happen, right? That's the question. How is it possible that Terrence and thousands of other individuals across the country, thousands, were sentenced to die in prison before they were old enough to get a tattoo, to vote, certainly to buy a beer? How is it that that cruel indifference that Terrence experienced as a child, how is that woven into our laws and policies? And maybe most importantly, how do we correct course, right? So those are the central questions of the war on kids. Okay, so the first question, how did this happen? So the war on kids, like mass incarceration itself, is a relatively recent phenomenon. The United States invented the juvenile court at the end of the 19th century in Illinois. And it wasn't perfect by any stretch. It was not perfect. But it was prompted by this ethic of paternalism, right? And this shared recognition that children who break the law or who are accused of breaking the law, they're typically in need of social services, right, rather than punishment, and certainly not the kind of punishment that we would mete out for adults. So that was the basic concept behind the juvenile court model that was invented in 1899. And over the course of the 20th century, every other state in this country adopted the idea of a juvenile court, a separate judicial system for kids, as did every developed nation around the globe. But the interesting thing is that while we were exporting that idea to other states and to other countries, we also were abandoning it domestically. And in order to understand how that happened and how it happened in such a short period of time, relatively speaking, I think it helps to think of the war on kids as a subplot to the story of mass incarceration. And I don't know how much folks know about that story, but it's certainly in the headlines a lot. Today in the United States, there are more than 2 million adults and children behind bars. In 1970, there were fewer than 200,000. So that's pretty dramatic, right? That means in the last four decades, we've seen the population balloon 10 times. And that's just my lifetime. So this is a new phenomenon, the mass incarceration phenomenon. And as I'm sure you know just from reading headlines again, mass incarceration has not affected Americans equally, right? Four out of five criminal defendants are poor. And while those criminal defendants are entitled to a lawyer, a zealous lawyer, actually, most public defenders are overworked and underpaid, and as a result, those individuals, poor defendants, don't receive on a regular basis, do not receive the kind of zealous representation to which they're entitled under the Sixth Amendment. So that's a poverty issue. There's also a race issue with our system. As Michelle Alexander and the New Jim Crow and others have documented, mass incarceration has taken a tremendous toll on minority communities. Minorities in America today are exponentially more likely to be under correctional control. Black and Latino communities in this country comprise less than one-third of the general population, more than two-thirds of the correctional population. So there's just a huge overrepresentation in the system. You may have seen, again, this came up during the presidential debates, that one in three black males born today, based on current incarceration rates, one in three black males born today can expect to spend some time in prison. I mean, that's just shocking, right? That's a damning statistic. So with the rise of crime in the 1970s, there was, in fact, a steady increase in crime in this country between the 1970s and the 1990s, peaking in the mid-1990s. And what happened is that politicians across the political spectrum adopted tough-on-crime policies, right, felt this political need to be tough on crime. In some ways, on the left, even more so, I think, more pressure. So, again, across the political spectrum, across the nation, lawmakers enacted more criminal laws, right, put more crimes on the books, and also attached stiffer sentences for those crimes. So as we sent more people to prison for longer periods of time, our prison population ballooned. And juveniles suffered from that trend, too. There were really two pieces of these tough-on-crime policies that were particularly detrimental to kids. And those were transfer laws and the introduction of what are called mandatory minimums. So let me say a little bit about each of those. So transfer laws. For most of the 20th century, a child who was accused of a crime was dealt with in juvenile court, that juvenile court model I mentioned that was founded in Illinois. In rare cases, if a prosecutor thought that the child had been accused of a crime that just exceeded the punitive limits of the juvenile court, in rare cases, the prosecutor could seek to have that case moved to adult court. But the prosecutor had to ask a judge, right, had to convince a judge that this case was one that really couldn't be handled in juvenile court. And so that process was rare and it was difficult. As part of tough-on-crime politics, though, of the 1980s and 1990s, lawmakers passed what are called transfer laws that made it increasingly easy and increasingly common for kids to be transferred out of juvenile court into adult court. So every jurisdiction in the country today has at least one provision. Many have several provisions that allow a child, just through legislative fiat, that allow a child, it's just a fiction, right, to be prosecuted as an adult. In some jurisdictions, in fact, in 21 jurisdictions, there is no minimum age that a child must be in order to be transferred to adult court. And in many jurisdictions, there are what are called once an adult, always an adult provisions, which means if a 15-year-old is charged as an adult in one crime, going forward, he or she will always be charged as an adult. So we just saw in the late 20th century this radical change in the ease with which cases could be charged against kids in adult court. And around the exact same time, that 1980s, 1990s period, states were also moving from what were called indeterminate sentencing schemes to determinate sentencing schemes. We hear about that more in the context of mandatory minimums. So before the 1980s, a judge would usually have had the opportunity to look at a case, to look at both the nature of the offense, the nature of the offender, although I hate that term, it's a placeholder, and exercise some discretion about what the appropriate sentence would be. But the move away from that toward determinate sentencing schemes meant that the legislature set in advance what sentence attached to a given crime. So we started sentencing based on the offense, not the offender. And so this was the perfect storm for kids, right? It was the perfect storm for kids. It's not even clear, in my research, it's obvious to me that it's not even clear that lawmakers were thinking about the interaction of these two things. But what happened is that you had kids ending up in adult court, right, with increasing frequency and ease. And once they got there, they were subject to these mandatory minimums that were drafted with adults in mind. I'll give you an example of what that looks like on the less extreme end of the spectrum. There are certainly life without parole cases that were mandatory, and those are the extreme end of the spectrum. But Andre Lyle, his case came out of Iowa. And at 17, Andre had a fight with a high school classmate over a $5 bag of marijuana. Andre, in his mind, he had paid for this bag of marijuana, he was entitled to it, and he had a fist fight in the schoolyard. And he punched his classmate, and he grabbed that $5 bag of marijuana, and he bolted. Well, he was charged with second-degree robbery. He was transferred to adult court, and he was convicted as an adult of second-degree robbery. And the judge, in his case, had no choice but to impose the mandatory minimum that the legislature had set. And that mandatory minimum was 10 years prison time, with 7 years required before parole eligibility. So there's no way, I mean, I'm an optimist by nature, there is no way that the legislators who enacted that statute were thinking about a schoolyard fight over a $5 bag of marijuana when they put a 10-year mandatory minimum on that. And yet, that's just an example of how that worked. And had he been in juvenile court, that never would have happened. Or at least the judge would have had some choice. So that's sort of a quick, really quick, primer on how we got here, right? How did we simultaneously invent the juvenile court and then within 100 years abandon its very premise? I want to turn now and talk a little bit about Supreme Court decisions in this area. For the latter half of the 20th century, the Supreme Court didn't do a lot on kids, right? It didn't look at a lot of juvenile sentencing issues or juvenile procedural rights after the mid-1960s. For those of us interested in this, the last decade or so has been really an interesting time. And I talk about this hopefully in a way that is accessible to non-lawyers. I want this to be accessible to non-lawyers because we need non-lawyers to understand what's going on and to feel invested in changing this. So I'll try to do that tonight, too, and just talk about three cases that are really crucial. So beginning in 2005, in a series of cases that are referred to as the Miller Trilogy, the Supreme Court began to rein in the extent to which states could subject kids to the most severe sanctions at law. And those sanctions are the death penalty and life without parole. So 2005, case called Roper versus Simmons, the court looked at the question of whether or not Christopher Simmons could be executed for a homicide he'd committed as a teenager. There was no claim of actual innocence. There was no argument regarding incompetence. It was just his age, right? His argument was, I'm a kid. And it was a hard case because the facts of it were pretty brutal. And nonetheless, the Supreme Court held that the Eighth Amendment bars the death penalty for juveniles, right, categorically, even those who commit homicide. And the court held that juveniles are less culpable and they're more amenable to rehabilitation. And this decision, the Roper versus Simmons decision, is really crucial today, even though it's 12 years old now, because it set the stage for these later decisions in the sense that the court relied heavily on neuroscience in the Roper decision. So that science tells us what every parent knows, certainly what I know from mothering a 9 and a 12-year-old boy. So the frontal lobe of our brain is not fully developed until well into our 20s. And that is the part of our brain that governs things like judgment and long-term decision-making and risk assessment and planning. And so because that part of the brain is underdeveloped until well into the 20s, guess what? Kids are impulsive. They don't think about long-term consequences. They're not good at risk assessment. They're more subject to peer pressure than their adult counterparts are. So the linchpin of that Roper Court's decision was kids are different. They're different biologically. They're not just small adults. They are actually different. And we need to treat them differently in the eyes of the law. So that was 2005. Court abolishes death penalty for kids. It's a little scary that it took us until 2005 to do that, but it did. And so 5 years later, in Graham versus Florida, the court heard Terrence Graham's challenge to that life without parole sentence that I mentioned at the beginning of my remarks. And Terrence had a great attorney, a guy named Brian Gowdy, who argued his case before the Supreme Court. And his claim was, kids like Terrence have what we think of as twice diminished culpability. Right? Number one, he's a kid, or he was at the time of the crime. And number two, this is not a homicide crime. And so typically, the death penalty and life without parole, because they are the two most severe sanctions we have on the books, those are things that we think of as being reserved for homicide offenses, typically. Or at least there was a point in time when we did. So Terrence's argument before the Supreme Court was, given that I'm a juvenile, given that I committed a non-homicide offense, this life without parole sentence, which is, by the way, analogous to a death penalty for a kid, right? If you're serving a life without parole sentence, you're serving a far greater proportion of your life if you enter that sentence as a teen. And the court agreed. And it's almost as if the court was really reaching to find a way to hold that this was cruel and unusual. And so for people like me who were really invested in following this case, this was a huge decision. Many people at the time said, this is not a huge decision, and here's why. So I mentioned that Terrence was serving life without parole for a non-homicide offense. If you had to guess, how many people in the country would you think are serving that sentence, a similar sentence, people like Terrence? Well, it was about 130. That's not a lot. When you have 2 million people behind bars, that's not a lot of people. So at first, there were many, even many academics, who thought this is just a Florida case because most of those 130 individuals were in Florida. I mean, and just as an aside, Florida is just a disaster on the criminal justice front, right? I mean, it's like an outlier among outliers. And so at the time of Graham versus Florida, people thought, okay, this is just a weird case. It's mostly about Florida, about 130 kids. They're going to get a parole hearing, they're going to get denied, and they're going to be sent back to spend their life in prison. You might think, huh, okay, well, he can't get life without parole for that attempted armed robbery. What isn't it? Right? Think about how Brown versus Board of Education was implemented. It was not implemented peacefully. It was not implemented because the lower courts and state legislatures said, oh, separate is not equal, right? It did not happen that way. And so when it comes to these decisions, as you can imagine, there's much to be excited about, right? But it's not all encouraging. So I'll start with the encouraging stuff. In 2011, the year before the court heard Evan Miller's challenge to his juvenile life without parole sentence, there were only 5 states in the country that banned juvenile life without parole, that recognized the unfairness of that sentence. And as of this year, 19 states plus the District of Columbia have banned juvenile life without parole. So that's pretty good, right? That's pretty good progress. Parole reviews are underway in states that had significant juvenile life without parole, JLWAP is the term we use for those populations. Massachusetts and California, significant JLWAP populations, parole proceedings are underway for some of those individuals. So that's encouraging. Now to the less encouraging news. The Graham decision. Let's start with Graham. So Graham versus Florida. The court says juveniles cannot be sentenced to life without parole if they're convicted of non-homicide offenses. So Terrence's case, for example, he was sent back to the Florida courts, and those courts were to then resentence him to a more appropriate sentence. So you might think, he can't get life without parole for that attempted armed robbery. What is an appropriate sentence? He received a 25-year sentence. So if he survives, he'll be 39, almost 39, when he's released from prison for that attempted armed robbery of that barbecue restaurant at 16. That, in my opinion, is a travesty. But sadly, he's one of the lucky individuals. You know, I mentioned there were about 130-some-odd individuals in his sort of similarly situated pool. Some of the individuals whose cases were revisited by lower courts received 45 years, 65 years, how about 89 years? A federal court recently upheld an 89-year sentence and said it's not the same thing as life without parole for a non-homicide offense because they were consecutive sentences that added up to 89 years, as opposed to a flat life without parole sentence. So there is now, and there will be for quite some time, litigation around what is a de facto life sentence, right? And how far can a court push it in terms of imposing a sentence that is, in my opinion, certainly the equivalent of life. So there's another question of implementation that comes from Graham. The Graham court said someone like Terrence may in fact end up needing to serve his entire life in prison, but the state cannot make that decision on the day it sentences that person. Right? They need to do some kind of periodic assessment. And actually what the court said is they need to provide a meaningful opportunity to obtain release. And again, the court doesn't say what that means. It says you need to give them a meaningful opportunity to obtain release. And it's up to the states to determine what that means. So, for example, is geriatric release a meaningful opportunity for a juvenile to obtain release? I would say no. I would say that's an end run around what the court asked the states to do. One state has tried to argue that. How about a parole process that is all but defunct, right? Part of the tough on crime policies of the 80s were abolition of parole. Right, they included abolition of parole in many jurisdictions. And if not legal abolition of it, de facto. Right, it's largely gone, and or when the parole board meets, no one gets paroled. Right, and there's no explanation of why. There's no basis upon which to appeal. There's no right of appeal. There's no transparency. So, again, is that a meaningful opportunity to obtain release? I would argue no. These are open questions, and literally, the answers to these questions will determine whether people will die in prison for adolescent mistakes like Terrence's. So those are some questions of implementation that really demand attention from the legal community. Similarly, the Miller court, Evan Miller's case, even though the court said that it wasn't outright banning juvenile life without parole, it did say, as I mentioned, that appropriate circumstances for that sentence should be exceedingly rare. And that is not proving to be the case. So Michigan, for example. Michigan is one of the states that houses a high population of juvenile lifers. And in that jurisdiction, because those 300-some-odd individuals in that state are entitled to a new sentencing hearing, the prosecutor has to decide what he or she is going to ask for, right? Well, again, because the court said that JLWAP should be an exceedingly rare sentence, one would think that it wouldn't be all or even that many of those 300 cases. But the prosecutors in Michigan are seeking juvenile life without parole all over again for more than half of the inmates in the state. So we're not seeing robust implementation of these cases. And then I should mention that one of the things that really shocked me in my research was just to understand the scale and the scope of this problem. So the implementation of Graham and Miller that I've talked about, for example, does not even begin to touch cases that aren't within those holdings. So in other words, I'll give you a couple examples. I get letters from inmates across the country all the time who say, here's my situation. I entered into a plea agreement at 16. Part of the plea agreement was waiving my right to an appeal, and I agreed to a 65-year term sentence. Can I get some relief under these? Because if I serve 65 years, I'm definitely going to die in prison. And it seems like what the court was getting at is that I shouldn't die in prison for something I did at 16 without ever getting a second look. And I agree with that person who's writing me that letter, but his case does not fall within the Graham and Miller decisions. It may someday, there may be a court that says, well, the spirit of what the Supreme Court meant in those cases suggests that individual should get a second look. But as a matter of rigid interpretation, it doesn't. And that's really heartbreaking, right? Because, as I said, in my opinion, those are cases where we sentenced a child to die in prison. And under the Supreme Court's directives, those individuals are entitled to a review of those sentences, and they're not always getting them. So ending the war on kids requires vigilance from the legal community, certainly, in terms of really pushing hard for the implementation of these cases. And then, of course, there's this whole other space of where I'd like to see the case law go. I think that those cases tell us that kids belong in juvenile court and that mandatory transfer laws should also be unconstitutional under those decisions. And there is some movement to argue for that. I've heard from lawyers saying, hey, you wrote a law review article about that. Can we translate that into a legal challenge? So hopefully that's on the horizon. Similarly, I think mandatory minimums are problematic enough for adults, but they have no place when sentencing children. They're just completely inappropriate in my mind. And I think they're also unconstitutional after these recent Supreme Court decisions. Those are two things I think we need to do in terms of pursuing a war for kids, is just keep at it on the criminal justice reform front, keep at it as lawyers in the legal community trying to really make sure these cases have meaning as they trickle down to the states. And the last thing I'll talk about tonight is this idea of arguing against incarceration for youth, just across the board, arguing against incarceration and for rehabilitation. And so, you know, one of the things that's really sobering is that youth incarceration rates are down today than they were at their peak in the mid-1990s, but we still have too many kids in the system. We have, on average, about 1 million arrests per year. About 1/4 of those cases go through the adult court system. On any given day, there are about 50,000 kids sitting in juvenile detention, and there are another 10,000 kids sitting in an adult correctional facility, mostly a jail, right, where they're awaiting their hearings. And that's just crazy. That's a huge amount of kids. And we don't reserve it for serious offenses. Sometimes people hear that and think, well, that must be a lot of law-breaking kids. Yes, there are kids who commit serious crimes. But only about 25% of kids in juvenile detention are being held on the basis of serious offenses. And by serious, I mean things like aggravated assault, sexual assault, homicide, and armed robbery. Those are serious offenses. But only about 1/4 of the kids in detention are even charged with those, which means we've got a ton of kids in the system who are there because they're doing age-appropriate things, right? They're acting out in the hallways in high school, or they've broken a curfew, or they were drinking alcohol in public, right? Technically, those are crimes. They're status offenses because of the status of being a juvenile. You obviously can't be drinking. You can't be out past curfew. But the problem, in addition to just the soul-crushing aspect of incarceration, the problem is that we know youth incarceration has what's called a criminogenic effect, which is just a very fancy way of saying that it makes someone a better criminal. Right? If you put a child who has a history of trauma, and most kids in the system have a history of trauma, 2/3 have a mental health diagnosis, if you put that child in a correctional facility, it's easy to see why they're going to become better criminals, if you will, right? Youth incarceration is a survival experience, whether it's in youth detention or in an adult prison. It is truly a survival experience. Most young people in prison who write to me universally wake up each day hoping to survive that day, hoping to survive it, meaning fending off physical and sexual assault. And the choice, if you're trying to fend off assault, is either to succumb to that, right, which is obviously traumatic, or to be aggressive. in prison, there are so many rules, and individuals can get tickets, disciplinary write-ups, whatever the facility calls them, for any number of things, not just for fighting or fending off a fight, but for things like, you know, walking too close to a fence, or not keeping your cell neat enough, or being late for a visitor, right? You're walking a gauntlet all the time. And the skills that a person needs to acquire in order to survive that incarceration experience are exactly the opposite of what they need to be productive members of society. Right? And at the same time, we know that 80% of youth who are charged as adults will be back in society before their 21st birthday. Right? So even if readers, listeners, citizens, even if people don't empathize with the plight of kids who enter the system, and I do, I think the system is rigged, and that it's rigged along class and racial lines. But even if you don't empathize with that, we all have a collective interest. Just because we know these kids are coming back into society, we have a collective interest in ensuring that we keep kids out of facilities to the extent that we can. And that when they really need to be there, that we ensure that that form of detention improves that child rather than further damaging them. So I will end there. Thank you so much for your attention.
You mentioned that many of the prosecutors who are moving children into the adult system have some options as to whether they're doing that. What is the pressure to move them into the adult system, and do they feel like the results are appropriate? I mean, are there people saying, yeah, we think life without parole is appropriate for this guy?
Sometimes prosecutors have discretion. There are three ways a child can end up in adult court. So three different transfer mechanisms. The first is that old-fashioned way, where the prosecutor has to go to the judge and say, here's a kid who I think belongs in adult court. And that's to your question of like, do they really think that's a good thing? And I'll come back to that. The second is what's called direct file, where the law says nothing about whether the kid needs to be in juvie or adult court, and the prosecutor can just do that without discussing it with the judge. That's the most problematic. And the other are what are called statutory exclusion laws that say if you're above a certain age or charged with a certain offense, it's just the nature of the offense, then the prosecutor doesn't have to make a choice. It's just that case is going to be dealt with in adult court. But when we're talking about things that involve the discretion of the prosecutor, at the risk of sounding like a deeply cynical person who's anti-prosecutor, and I'm not, right? I tell my students all the time, I encourage them to be prosecutors because we need good prosecutors. But I think that one of the dangers is that prosecutors are judged by success, and success involves things like conviction rates and length of sentence. And add to that the fact that in some jurisdictions they elect their prosecutors. And, you know, you look at the 39 jurisdictions that elect their judges, and those judges are campaigning on the severity of sentences, right, that they've been able to hand down. So I do think that there's a culture on the prosecution side that can lead to this sense of the more people I can convict and the stiffer the sentences I can get, the better I'm doing. And that's just a cultural danger in prosecution's offices.
What has been the role of law schools in creating perhaps an environment that encourages this level of prosecution against juveniles?
We're certainly in a phase in legal education where, again, because of the American Bar Association, there's a push toward focusing on a renewed focus on things like representing the indigent on a pro bono basis and that sort of thing. But I don't know that law schools are making that worse. I'd like to think we're not. I'd be lying if I didn't say that I think my colleagues, for example, who were prosecutors before they came to academia, they probably teach criminal procedure very differently than I do, right? And I would imagine that that affects people's sense of what's right and appropriate for prosecutors.
I wanted to get your opinion on two different issues,
okay.
two things that came to mind during your talk. One is, it seems to me that as long as we have a capitalist system in which people are making money off of others being in prison, that there's, as long as there's a financial incentive for people to be there, the prison population is going to keep growing. So, you know, while we can look at the case studies and at the micro level and say, this person shouldn't be in jail for this reason. They have XYZ factors, class, race, etc. I'm more curious in terms of like the big picture, like what you think is actually going on in terms of intent, which then brings me. So that's the one issue is the private prisons and what you see is that. The second question is related, which is I don't know if people here have seen the movie 13th on the third. Yeah, same director as Selma. That movie really opened up a lot of people's eyes, definitely opened up my eyes. And one of the things that was quoted in there was Nixon's advisor saying that the reason that they started the war on drugs was so they could go after the black rights, civil rights movement, people on the left, progressives. And that then directly feeds into, again, not only are we locking people up and targeting activists in certain aspects, but then making money off the fact that they're now in prison working for us. So can you comment on those two things, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So to the first point, so the private prison thing, I think, unfortunately, I wish it were just a question of we need to get rid of private prisons because that would be a much simpler fix. Private prisons actually comprise a very small percentage of correctional facilities that we have in this country. There's no doubt that they're problematic for the reasons that you articulated. I think the bigger concern that we do need to be going after, just given the proportion of prisons that are actually private, the issue that I think is driving the profit concerns you mentioned are unions representing correctional officers. So, you know, prisons are built, not coincidentally, in faraway places so that we can pretend that people who commit a crime or some criminals are elsewhere, not human beings like the rest of us. And so it's out of sight, out of mind. But oftentimes, you know, you go to visit, well, at least I do in my research, a prison, and you got to drive like 4 hours from a major metropolis to get there. And so that's the town's employment. Right, and we see that across the country that correctional officers are very resistant. The unions are very resistant to job loss, right, or to anything that would reduce the need for that. So that, I think, is a bigger issue and needs more direct confrontation in the political process than even the private prison issue. To your second point, there is no doubt that that the war on crime, the war on drugs, the war on kids, it's been racially coded from the beginning. If you look, you mentioned the Nixon era issue. Same was true, I would say, also with the war on drugs in the Reagan era. I mean, the war on drugs, you know, we started ramping up the war on drugs and rolling out federal money to beef up state-level law enforcement long before the crack epidemic, right? It was not we had a crack epidemic and then we responded with beefed up law enforcement. It was actually predated that. And so I think, and you know, you think about the rhetoric and the images of what the war on drugs entailed and the image that the administration was putting forth of like welfare queens and just, you know, this idea. I mean, it was so racially coded, you almost can't believe that they got away with saying it. So I absolutely agree. And that's why I mentioned Michelle Alexander's work, because, you know, her argument, her claim in her book, The New Jim Crow, is that the correctional system today is what Jim Crow laws once were. Right? First we had slavery, and then we had Jim Crow laws, and now we have the correctional system. And that it's basically accomplishing the same end as both of those prior institutions, slavery and Jim Crow.
You mentioned Reagan and Nixon. Did incarceration rates go down under the Obama administration, or did they go up?
Mm-hmm.
And do you see any real difference between the two parties on this issue?
I wish I could say there's a huge difference. Clinton signed in 94 one of the worst federal laws in terms of ramping up, you know, cracking down mandatory minimums, juvenile transfer laws. Obama certainly was better. I'm not sure if it was because he was a Democrat or if it was because he was in a moment where he could be, right? I mean, he was the first sitting president to visit a prison. He oversaw the clemency initiative that really ushered in the release of first-time nonviolent drug offenders who were serving these huge, long sentences in federal prisons. But I'm not sure that we can say, oh, that's because he was blue and the others were red. I just I wish it were that simple, but it hasn't been historically. And even Hillary Clinton, when she was on the campaign trail, had to deal with the fact that she had really been a part of that 94 crime bill.
Mm-hmm. So I completely agree with you that it is a reform of the criminal justice system and all those other absolutely necessary forms that we as citizens must be looking at, because I think it's our democracy. It's not, it is at stake, no question. I appreciate the work you've done, but I encourage us all to give consideration about how suddenly the Koch brothers want to get on board. I think we have to look a little bit deeper, because what my brain says is, does this make sense?
Right. I will say this. I mention them just as an example of sort of unlikely allies in this process. I am hugely encouraged by, and this is democracy in action, what's driving this is the electorate. So California is a great example. California has a world-class educational system, or at least it once did, right? I went to law school in California. Their state school system is very impressive. Well, they reached a point where they were spending more on corrections than higher education, right? That's true in 18 states, but California is a huge state, right? So for them to be spending more on corrections than higher education is a big deal. And when their citizenry realized that, they said, you know what? We're fed up. And so they abolished the nation's most severe three strikes provision. Right? California had the most severe three strikes law on the books that said if you commit, you know, three felonies, that by the third strike you're serving automatic life without parole. The voters overturned that three strikes provision and only narrowly upheld the death penalty by referendum. So I think it is a grassroots thing that's driving this change. And a lot of it is coming from fiscal concerns where the taxpayers are saying, that's not where I want my money going. I want my money going to schools, not prisons.
I want to thank you for your advocacy and everything. I am a formerly incarcerated person who served a 10-year mandatory minimum in federal prison.
Okay.
When people say the system is broken, it seems to me that the system is working exactly the way that it was designed.
Yeah.
If we understand the history of the prison industrial complex. And so I just kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on that, because I think maybe it's broken for us, the people, but for the people that are benefiting off incarceration, you know, new slavery and...
So I agree with what you're saying, that there are vested interests that stand to benefit from this industrial complex, and as long as it's in existence, they will stand to benefit. That's why I said I'm not as troubled by the private prisons as I am by the unions and the employees of correctional facilities, only because the private prisons are smaller in number. When I say it's broken, I guess I'm bringing to it the perspective of a lawyer and an advocate. So when I say it's broken, I mean it's broken in the sense that we should not have two systems in this country, and we do, right? So Brian Stevenson is a Supreme Court advocate, argues for kids all the time. He says all the time when he talks that you are better off in this country being guilty and wealthy than poor and innocent, and he's right. And that is scary, and it's wrong, and it's unconstitutional, and it should be an embarrassment to this country. So that's what I mean when I say it's broken, that, you know, we've said since 1963 that if you're a poor person accused of a crime, you have the right to an attorney because the state can't just hail you into court and throw you away without representation. We say that, but 55 years later, that right has never been realized on the ground. That's how it's broken, right? Or the fact that 94% of cases in this country are resolved through a plea bargaining process where the prosecutor basically exacts everything they can from that person. Why? Because they can. Right? That's how it's broken. So I agree with what you said. I'm just coming at it from a constitutional perspective. Like, thanks for your work.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you all so much. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
You were just listening to Kara Drynan on the justice system's war on kids. She spoke at Town Hall in Seattle. Kara Drynan is professor of law at Catholic University, and she's the author of The War on Kids, How American Juvenile Justice Lost Its Way. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Michelle Alexander, Brian Stevenson, Jonathan Kozel, Nancy McLean, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Angela Davis. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Kara Drynan on the Justice System's War on Kids, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Ed Mays recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Tune in to Democracy Now!, Monday through Friday, 12 noon.
On Free Radio Santa Cruz, also known as Freak Radio, community-based FM radio station, which people certainly here know, operating without an FCC license since 1995.
Democracy Now!, 12 noon, Monday through Friday, on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM or freakradio.org. Also check out democracynow.org.
Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The Department of Justice and the FBI feel that this is a extraordinarily reckless step to take because the information hasn't been vetted. This is not about the facts. This is about a narrative that the chairman wants to put out, a misleading narrative, to undermine the FBI, undermine the department, and ultimately undermine Bob Mueller.
A showdown is brewing in Washington as the White House prepares to release a controversial Republican memo, despite opposition from the FBI, the Justice Department, and Democratic lawmakers. Are Trump and his Republican allies trying to discredit Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's investigation of President Trump? We'll get the latest. Then to Afghanistan.
Our warriors in Afghanistan have new rules of engagement. Along with their heroic Afghan partners, our military is no longer undermined by artificial timelines, and we no longer tell our enemies our plans.
Trump promises a new strategy in the longest U.S. war in history. We'll look at why civilian casualties are soaring in Afghanistan. On Saturday, more than 100 people died in Kabul when an ambulance packed with explosives blew up. We'll go to Kabul. Then, is everything you know about depression wrong? We'll speak with Johan Hari, author of Lost Connections, uncovering the real causes of depression and the unexpected solutions. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The FBI said Wednesday it has grave concerns over President Trump's plans to release a four-page document written by Republican House Intelligence Committee Chair Devin Nunes, purporting to show the FBI abused its power when it began surveilling Trump campaign advisor Carter Page in 2016 due to his dealings with Russia. Supporters of President Trump claim the memo offers proof the FBI's investigation was tainted by politics from the start, in part because the FBI won approval of the wiretap by citing a dossier funded by supporters of Hillary Clinton. The memo is expected to lay blame on the actions of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, the same man who's the only official with the authority to fire Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller. Earlier this week, House Intelligence Committee Republicans voted along party lines to declassify the memo, which had become a rallying cry for President Trump and his supporters. In a highly unusual statement issued Wednesday, the FBI said it was, quote, provided a limited opportunity to review this memo the day before the committee.